It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It's snowing in Denver. What the hell? Rico Bronya. Welcome in. What episode are we up to? 685. Welcome into Rico Bronya. The Mets are in the midst of a three-game series against the Colorado Rockies. They won on Monday afternoon. Tuesday got snowed out. Wednesday got moved from a day game to a night game. And Thursday was supposed to be a common off day, and it turned into an afternoon game. So this Met-Rocky series has been deeply affected by weather, and it gives us a chance to kind of pause. It's like a halftime in the middle of this series against the Rockies and in the midst of a West Coast slash Mountain Zone road trip that the Mets are involved in, and they are off to a good start when it comes to wins and losses, a record of 3-1. We recap the Angels series if you want to go back an episode. What we'll do on today's Rico is we'll read a lot of your emails, so we'll use it as an opportunity to hear from you. We will talk about the Game 1 victory, and I'll start with just a couple of thoughts about DeGrom, because I was there. I went to Yankee Stadium to watch Jacob DeGrom twirl against the Yankees, and you know, I've watched a little bit of DeGrom over the years, and his overall numbers are good. Like, he came into the start with an ERA of 2.05. It went up a bit because he gave up six runs. He left with two guys on base, and his bullpen did not do a good job of, you know, stranding those runners. But I was saying this to my son and a buddy of mine watching him. Jake is still good. He is not great. He is just not the same guy, even when he's effective, even when, you know, he gets through six innings and allows a run or two. He's just not the same dominant pitcher he used to be, which is okay. He's 37 years old. It's to be expected. But I kind of enjoyed watching him as a Ranger at Yankee Stadium because I felt no pressure. He gives up a two-run home run to Ryan McMahon, and it's kind of like, all right. Gives up a home run to Jazz Chisholm, and it's like, all right. It sucks. Like, I'd rather see DeGrom throw seven scoreless against the Yankees, but the affiliation when it comes to the team is gone, and so is the emotion. So it was cool to see him. It was fun to be at Yankee Stadium for six and a half innings because I did leave once DeGrom was pulled, but he's not the same guy. And I go back and forth on this, and I know that I always said, like, let's wait for the 5 years to run out, and then we'll have, like, a nice discussion on if the Mets made the right call or not the right call. I think from an emotional standpoint, it would have been great for DeGrom to finish his career with the Mets. Look at David Wright. I always use him as an example. The Mets kept David Wright and let him end his career as a New York Met. That contract they gave him wasn't a good one. It didn't age well. Obviously, injuries had a lot to do with it. But I think most of us, especially all these years later, would say, even though the contract didn't work out, it's really cool and it was special that David Wright finished his career as a New York Met. So I guess from that standpoint, you would say, it would have been fine giving DeGrom a five-year deal, even if he misses the first year because of Tommy John and most of the second year because of Tommy John and year three and four, and we'll see about year five. He's good, but he's not great. I think from that lifetime Met standpoint, it would have been worth it. But I try to analyze it fairly, considering what the Mets did and what DeGrom has done. And we are in the fourth year of that big decision, and it's still, like, incredibly murky. It really is. I said this on the air about Tarek Skubal on Evan and Tiki, and I'll say it here because we will talk a little bit about Skubal, who's dealing with his injury, that when you sign a pitcher, and maybe someday David Stearns will, to a long-term contract, if you sign a guy to an eight-year deal, I'm not judging that contract that all 8 years have to be great because that's not realistic. I would almost look at a long-term contract for a pitcher and say, if half of it, just half of it, is that guy pitching at a high level, then it was probably worth the contract. Some may disagree with that. I just want to be reasonable because pitchers break down all the time. So when you look at a five-year deal that was handed out to a guy in his mid-30s with an injury history, and it appears, because right now he's in year four, and year one and year two were basically nothing because injuries deeply affected it. Year three was a really solid year. Year four so far has been a really solid year. If he ends up with two of the 5 years being solid years, which is 40% of the contract that you gave to a guy in his mid-30s, does that make it a success? It's a tough one. And I think when you look at what the Mets ended up doing, and we'll do a whole Rico on this at the end of next season, I'm sure, they use that money to sign Verlander. Then they dump Justin Verlander, right? They get two prospects, one of which we'll find out about, Ryan Clifford. The other one is gone, and Drew Gilbert, who they used for a rental reliever. But then they go out and sign, take your pick, Sean Manaea, Luis Severino. One of those guys is used with the money that they didn't give DeGrom. And so 2024 would have been greatly affected because DeGrom missed 70% of the season. And take your pick on Manaea or Severino. Both of those guys contributed the Mets heavily to making the playoffs in 2024. So the whole thing is incredibly complicated. But I promise we'll do a Rico on that at the end of the 2027 season. Let's take a look at game one of this series against the Colorado Rockies. Look, the Mets are playing games right now against bad teams. We saw them back at Citi Field not be able to take advantage of it. I still can't believe they got swept by the Colorado Rockies. And this game on Monday afternoon, it turned out to be a 5:40 first pitch, whatever it was. It's such a weird game when you go the route of the opener. But I have to admit, and I think we all have to admit, that when it comes to David Peterson and it comes to that fifth spot in the rotation, because right now you feel great about three guys. You feel great about, good to great, about Holmes, Peralta, and McClain. And Christian Scott right now is in that mode of, let's continue to give him an opportunity. I don't think anyone feels safe or great with Christian Scott, but he's only made two major league starts, recovering from Tommy John. One of them was a disaster. The other one was okay. So we'll put Scott in the corner as a let's wait and see. This fifth spot can't be Kodai Senga, who's now on the IL. It can't be Sean Manaea, who is a long reliever at best. And they're still hesitant for Jonah Tong or Weininger to come up. So you got David Peterson slash bullpen arms for that fifth spot. And for whatever reason, David Peterson has been much more effective used as a bulk guy. And watching this game on Monday was like, not an epiphany on this, or an epiphany, whatever it is. I don't remember. It's an N or an M. I'm not sure. Because I've known since the Rays started using the opener, like the reason behind it. I've never loved it, but I've understood it. But in the case of the Met bullpen and David Peterson, as I'm watching Monday's game, it hit me more than ever that this is the only way they can use David Peterson if it's not just becoming a straight reliever. Like, if they're going to try to find a way for this fifth spot in the rotation to be David Peterson eating a bunch of innings, using the opener and the way they executed it on Monday is the way to do it. First of all, you start a guy like Waskar Brazoban, who's been great, and they could have probably asked him to pitch a second inning. He got through the first inning. Really, the only issue was he hit a batter with one out and nobody on and worked through it, worked through a stolen base, a sac fly, and got Hunter Goodman to pop up to shortstop. So they probably could have squeezed out another inning from Brazoban. But what I loved what Mendy did, see, I'm actually going to compliment him, is that you can play these tricky games of, well, when am I going to use the bulk guy? I don't have to use him in the second inning. I could use another reliever, which is what he did with Austin Warren, and save him for the third inning. Or what he did Monday was he got two innings out of Austin Warren. He was bailed out by a great defensive play by Carson Bench. Otherwise, the Mets would have given up a run. But I like this. I like using David Peterson as a bullet in which you can tell your opponent, I may use him in the second inning. I may use him in the third inning. I may use him in the fourth inning. I can pick my spot on when in the batting order I'm going to use him. And think about the other thing that happened here. The Rockies ended up sitting all of their left-hand hitters, or at least four of their left-hand hitters, including a guy like Troy Johnston, who's hitting 321. And he sat him because they knew, well, David Peterson is coming into the game. So you can keep, with certain platoon teams, you can do this. You can keep all those left-handed bats on the bench and, you know, go three or four innings before you ever even use David Peterson. So I think in regards to this bullpen and this pitcher, I like using him as the bulk guy. It's like the first time in my life. It's only been, what, a half a decade that we saw the Tampa Bay Rays start this, where we're going to have an opener and then we're going to have a guy come in and eat a bunch of innings. It's still a somewhat new phenomenon. And a lot of times when the Mets have done it or other teams have done it, it felt like, what's the point? It felt like you're just trying to be too cute. But I think in this regard, it makes a lot of sense. I think with David Peterson and with this bullpen and the situation they're in, it made a lot of sense. And credit to Brazoban and Austin Warren. I was about to call him Wazabron. Maybe that's the combo. Maybe that's the tag team nickname for them when Austin Warren and Waskar Brazoban are getting nine outs. But what was great about it is he got to pick his spot on when to use David Peterson. Could have been the second, could have been the fourth. And Peterson was interesting, man, because he comes in and he retires the first 11 guys he faces. And as soon as Keith Hernandez said, wow, David Peterson could finish this game, that's when the jinx occurred. And again, what was so frustrating about when David Peterson lost it in the seventh inning of this game was much like what happened in Anaheim that we touched on, where the Mets gave up so many two-strike hits. Think about how things went bad for David Peterson. He's got two outs and nobody on. He's retired 11 in a row since coming into this game, and he's ahead of Willie Castro, 1-2, and he gives up a base hit. He has this long battle with Jordan Beck and then gets him to hit what should have been a 400-foot out, but Carson Bench, who's played so well recently, especially defensively, made a miscue. He turned the wrong way, and it turned into a triple, and it turned into a rocky run. And then he gives up an 0-2 hit to Kyle Karros. So all three hits come with two strikes, and two of the hits come ahead of the count. And it feels like it's happening way too much recently. And you start to question, is that pitch selection? Is that really where this issue is coming from? Because this happened in Anaheim. I mean, think about the one game they lost on this road trip, a two-strike pitch to Oswald Peraza. Cannot happen. And David Peterson struggles in the seventh inning of this game, which ended up short-circuiting his bulk performance, came with two outs and nobody on, and it came with two strikes on all three hitters and ahead of the count with two strikes on two of the three hitters. So it's a weird game for David Peterson because he ends up going four innings. He allows the two runs. He strikes out six guys, doesn't walk anybody. I'd say overall it was good. And that's the funny part about being a bulk guy. Because if he's the starter and he goes four innings and allows two runs and he's pulled after 70 pitches, we'd probably say that's not good enough. But when you're used in this role, in this situation, when you come into the game in the fourth inning, it's just completely different. So I think the Mets should keep doing this with David Peterson. I think he should continue to be this bulk guy where Mendy can play around on when he decides to use him. I always had this philosophy since I was a kid in which I never understood, I guess there are rules, but I never understood why you would ever announce who your starting pitcher is. And I remember reading a legendary story that John McGraw, before a game, had two pitchers warming up in the bullpen to come in and start the game. He wasn't going to tell his opponent who was going to pitch. And I think nowadays, because of gambling and you can't really do it. You can't not announce who your starter is. But what you can do, and it's completely legal, and Carlos Mendoza did it on Monday, is, yeah, you know a bulk guy's coming in. Yeah, you know this pretty much starting pitcher is going to pitch, but you don't know when. And then you've got to make a decision on how you want to line this up. Do you want to put in together a right-handed lineup? And who knows, maybe for the first three or four innings, your right-handed lineup is facing nothing but right-handed pitchers, which is exactly what happened with Brazoban and Warren. And you could have gone crazy. You could have used Craig Kimbrell early in this game. You could have. You know who you could use as an opener? You could use Luke Weaver as an opener. I don't think it's crazy. He's used to starting. He's done it before. So I think for now, in this moment, I think the Mets should continue to use David Peterson in that bulk role, following someone as an opener with Waskar Brazoban being the likely guy. Now, I showed a lot of restraint today here on this Rico Bronya because this is the first Rico we've done since I got what I wanted. And what I mean by that is for many, many months, for over a year now, it started as a suggestion. It turned into a demand. I have begged this manager to lead off Juan Soto. And I've gone on and on about why it makes sense, why it should happen, and why it started to feel like Carlos Mendoza just wouldn't give in to me. Whether it was at, what's that thing called? Fanatics Fest, when Carlos Mendoza joined us, and I asked him it there, or it was at spring training when we went down there, and I had a back and forth about it that you may have heard if you're a loyal Rico listener. And it started to feel as if Carlos Mendoza thought in the back of his mind, I'm not going to give that geek what he wants. So you will never see Juan Soto lead off. And there I am, minding my own business on a Monday afternoon. Mets with a 5:40 first pitch, which meant the lineup was going to come out while I was on the air. And I see that Juan Soto is leading off for really no particular reason. In the finale against the Angels, Bo Bichette is the leadoff hitter, went 2-for-5. He had a bad Saturday, which caused him to be the net negative for the Angels series, according to the Rico Brogna, when he had the two big outs in the 7th and 10th inning. But I just didn't see it coming because I didn't see why it would happen. The Mets have, you know, in a minor way been winning recently. So I was excited because I've wanted this for so long, but I was really surprised that this was the moment. And so I commend Carlos Mendoza for doing it. I commend Juan Soto for being okay with it because that was the other thought. I know Tiki had brought it up to me a few times saying maybe Juan Soto doesn't want to lead off, which is why I brought that up to Mendy in spring training. And he said, Juan Soto will do whatever is best for the team. And Carlos Mendoza picked May 4th, 2026, the opener of a three-game series against the Colorado Rockies to lead off Juan Soto. And Juan, did you have to swing at the first pitch and pop up to third base? Seriously, bro. I'm pushing for you to be the leadoff hitter, thinking you're going to draw a walk to start this game, and you swing at the first pitch and you pop up to third base. And really, the Met offense against Sagano did nothing. The only guy who showed a pulse was Mark Vientos, who had probably the hardest luck day you could ever have. He leads off the second inning with a home run that, well, should have been a home run in every other ballpark and on any other day at Coors Field, and somehow is caught at the wall by Mickey Moniak. A ball that is a home run 98% of the time. Then he comes up leading off the fifth inning and does the same thing. A home run on any other day. And it was excruciating because the Mets weren't getting any hits against Tomoyuki Sugano. So here's Mark Vientos twice hitting a ball that should have gone over the fence off a game in which he hit two home runs. Mark Vientos is a streaky player. And right now it feels like he's going through one of those really, really good streaks. He hits two balls that should have gone out. Then the softest contact he made all day was the two-run single that turned a 2-0 game into a 4-0 game. And then in the ninth inning, he hits another ball 110 miles per hour, and he lines out to the second baseman, Willie Castro. Temporarily, you feel good about Mark Vientos' bat. You're not confident it's going to last. You're not confident that he's arrived. But in this moment where the Mets are desperate for wins, Mark Vientos over the last few days has looked very good. Hopefully he can continue that. Hopefully the snow has not cooled him off. But he had on Monday maybe the most hard luck 1-for-4 you'll ever see. But it was typical with this LD offense. I mean, you get no hit for five innings by Sagano, in which other than the Vientos balls, they didn't make a lot of great contact. It's not like that was indicative of the way Sagano was throwing. That wasn't the case. Francisco Alvarez bounced into another double play after Carson Bench had a really good at-bat and drew a walk in the third inning. Alvarez is just a walking double play at this point. He is, you're talking about another guy that's just so up and down. There's a reason he went from batting fourth to batting eighth. I can't blame Mendoza for that. But luckily, the bats woke up in the sixth inning. Carson Bench, who we've talked about a lot recently, he's felt different. Really, ever since he got out of that major offer, and there was actually talk, Boomer brought it up to me at one point off air about sending him down, which I thought was way too early to even have that conversation. Carson Bench is slowly, because it hasn't been obvious, the numbers don't jump off the page, but he has slowly but surely shown progress. And it's funny, I said that to a friend of mine who had brought up, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, he said, Evan, I don't think Benj is ready. They should send him down. And this was in the midst of him starting to show a pulse. And I said, I get it. Like, I understand, like, he hasn't got off to a great start, but you can see it. You can see the at-bat quality. You can see the defense. You can just see even the look on his face. He just looked a lot better. He didn't look overwhelmed the way he did over the first 2-3 weeks of the season. And now you've got him making diving plays all over the place. I know he had the miscue on the triple, but remember, he made a really good defensive play in the third inning that bailed out Austin Warren on a Tyler Freeman fly ball to right center. And after drawing that walk in the third inning, he comes up in the sixth inning and hits an absolute bomb of a home run, and you needed it to be a bomb to get out of Coors Field on Monday. Set the tone for that sixth inning and eventually knocks Sagano out of the game because he gets the home run. Alvarez doubles, Torrens doubles, so you get the catchers both contributing. And then Mark Vientos bailed out Bichette and Memje Melendez, who both did not come through with a couple of guys on base. Vientos came through with the two-run hit, and so you see the offense explode for one big inning. And that was encouraging and really good to see, especially when it's the bottom of the order doing it. The problem is, that was it for the offense, and we see that so often. And four runs, you know, for this team feels like an offensive onslaught, but four runs is not, you want to do better than that. And so even in a win, and I'm gracious that they got the win, I'm gracious that four runs was enough, but after they score those four runs, nine in a row to end the game. And I'm not just trying to look for negatives, trust me. I am thrilled that the Mets have won three out of their last four games. I am thrilled about that, especially with the way they ended their homestand with that brutal loss to the Nationals. But again, you have an offense that in 8 of 9 innings does absolutely nothing. I'm going to blow your mind for a second. In 8 of 9 innings on Monday, three batters came to the plate. The minimum was faced in 8 out of 9 innings. In 7 of the 9 innings, it was legitimate 1-2-3 innings. The only exception is when Benj drew that walk and Alvarez promptly grounded into a double play. The offense continues to be a problem, but the pitching was awesome. Outside of David Peterson running into that trouble that we talked about in the 7th inning, the pitching did a great job. 3 scoreless to start from Brazoban and Warren. Craig Kimbrell was given a big opportunity in the 8th inning, and he worked around that triple he gave up to Mickey Moniak, had a big strike out of Tyler Freeman looking a 9-pitch at-bat, and then got the final out of that 8th inning. And then Devin Williams comes in, 2-run game, 4, 5, and 6 of the batting order, and looked great, and barely broke a sweat, and barely had to throw any pitches. So here's what we're seeing about the 2026 New York Mets, who still have a long way to go at 9 games under .500 as they are trying to chop wood to cut into that deficit. What we are seeing, I think, is what their identity needs to be. And that is a team that pitches really well. Because even in these wins recently, they just don't score enough runs. And I don't see it changing. I don't see where that magic is coming from. You can squint your eyes and look at this staff and see 3 starters that you feel pretty good about in Clay Holmes, who's off to an awesome start, Nolan McLean, who is coming off the worst start of his career, and Freddie Peralta. And you see a bullpen, which has been very up and down, but has the tools to be decent. You know, Brooks Raley has, for the most part, been really good. Devin Williams has settled in after that rough patch. Luke Weaver's had his bad moments, but he's also had his good moments. Oscar Brazoban has probably been pound for pound their best reliever. So I don't say it with an abundance of confidence. I just say that if you're looking for an identity, like a positive identity on how they can turn this season around, it comes from their pitching. That's where it comes from. Now, the Mets are not doing anything funky with their rotation because of the snow out. It's going to be Freddie Peralta and Christian Scott on Wednesday and Thursday. They had the option to bump up Nolan McLean to Thursday because Nolan's start was on Saturday. So they could have very easily had him on his 5th day and pitched him Thursday and skipped or pushed back Christian Scott because McLean didn't throw that many pitches in Saturday's game. But they're opting not to do that. They're going to keep McLean kind of on his day. are on his turn. And so Christian Scott will be tested by having to pitch at Coors Field. The whole thing is very strange in that the weather is so bad on Wednesday that it probably would be smart to bang that game too and have a doubleheader on Thursday, which luckily wouldn't affect the Mets that much because of the fact they have an off day on Monday. So that extra off day that they have coming after the road trip would at least smooth out any complications with the rotation. But I don't think the Rockies necessarily want to play a doubleheader on what was supposed to be an off day, and then they're traveling to Philadelphia. But they're going to play baseball on Wednesday in horrendous conditions. And then on Thursday, it's supposed to be a really nice day. So just thinking ahead on this, I think Juan Soto should probably DH on Wednesday's game. I'd say take him out of the lineup, but I don't think the Mets could afford that. You don't want to risk any kind of injury. Now, let's get to your emails, therico@gmail.com. Let me start off with Abe, who writes, Evan, I haven't listened to the last few Ricos, so I don't know if you've talked about this yet, but Tarek Skubo's elbow surgery greatly increases the chance that the Mets can sign him next offseason. The injury may make Skubo more inclined to take a short-term deal, which is right up the Mets' alley. I'm thinking 2 years, $110 million, with a player option. The Dodgers probably won't be a threat for him due to their large commitments to starting pitchers, so the door will be wide open for the Mets to snatch him up. I wrote a few months ago that I disagreed with your opinion on the Peralta trade, as if they re-sign Peralta, they won't get Skubal. Now there's a chance they can get both if they want to. Peralta on a long-term deal and Skubal on a short-term deal. I've been given this thought since the news came out that Skubal needs surgery. Like, how does this impact him in terms of free agency? And I think if he comes back in August, which is where the schedule kind of assumes it will be, that he would come back sometime in August. If he comes back in August and pitches well, and he looks like Tarek Skubal, I don't think this injury is going to affect him. Like, I think he'll be able to get whatever he was originally looking for in free agency. I think the only way that this injury really impacts Skubal's contract negotiations is if, A, he doesn't come back. Like, he just doesn't pitch this season. That would be a major red flag that I think would bring it down. And number two, if he just doesn't pitch well. Like, I could see that maybe hurting his value. But if I had to project right now here in early May, I think as long as he comes back and pitches well, I think he's going to be okay. I think he's going to get whatever the market was going to dictate and whatever he was going to get. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's going to affect it very much. Josh writes, the 15 and 20 perspective. Okay. Think about where we were just a week ago. The Mets and the Phillies were in the exact same boat with the same record. Today, the Phillies are 15 and 20, and we are 13 and 22. Obviously, there's a difference, but boy, doesn't it seem like if we had a 15 and 20 record right now, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. Oops, I just lost the email for a second. At 15 and 20, you don't feel like this is a crisis you can never get over. Being five games under 500 is something we can make up. We've done it before. We can do it again. I know the counter argument is we've been playing the Rockies and the Angels, two of the worst teams in baseball. It's not like we're out here hanging banners for beating them. It's not like guys are facing Randy Johnson or Greg Maddux every night. But the bottom line is I still believe in the potential of this roster. I like what I'm seeing out of Vientos, Benj, and Beatty. I think they have the capacity to make or break this team as the season goes on. If we were 15 and 20 right now, would you still be calling this a bad team? Or would you just say it's a group of good players playing poorly? I feel like there's plenty of time to bridge the 3.5 game gap and change the whole narrative. What do you think? Josh from Chevy Chase. When you put it in that simplistic way of, hey, if they were just three games better, would you still call them a bad team? I guess I'd have to know what three games did they win? What happened differently in those games that caused them to win? But no, I think I still would be calling them a bad team. Because it's the roster. And, you know, you hit on something about Vientos, Benj, and Beatty and how they could make or break this team. I think you're right. I think that's the rightest thing you sent in that email. That, and I talked a little bit about this last week, that we make a big deal out of Semien and Bichette and all the moves that were made and the veterans that aren't here and the guys that they brought in. And look, rightfully so. These veterans have not performed well. You know, Luis Robert Jr. is on the IL and fell off a cliff after a tough, after a really good start. So I don't want to minimize the guys that they brought in, but in a lot of ways, those young players that you talked about really are going to make or break this team. Brett Beatty is very, very important. Mark Vientos is very, very important. Like Carson Benz right now is an everyday outfielder. And so I think it is absolutely fair to say that those three young players and how they perform is going to go a long way in determining if the Mets are going to be able to turn their season around. But here's what I would ask you. Forget Benz, because he's a really young player who's shown a lot of promise over the last few weeks. Mark Vientos and Brett Beatty have been here for a long time, and they have gotten a lot of opportunities. Are you confident in either one of those guys, or dare I say both of those guys? Like, I don't think a lot of Mets fans are, and I would certainly tell you I'm not right now. I'm not confident in those guys, but you are right that their performance is going to heavily dictate if this team has success or not. You're right. I just don't necessarily have that much confidence in it.
How can you? I mean, after this is not like a year or two. This is going on like 4 years now with Vientos and Beatty, and eventually I always say this, and I mean this. I even talk this about, like, you know, in other sports and whatever. Sometimes a change of scenery is what it needs for somebody else to be successful. I'm not saying that Vientos and Beatty can't be good ball players, but they're not doing it here, and we kind of need them to step up. So it's just maybe their time here is over, move on, put them in, you know, the West Coast, and they'll be better. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, but the first part of what you said is the truth, which is they need them. You know, yeah. They need them. Like, I'll read this email by Dan, who I have gone from calling Negative Dan to the Archivist. I like that nickname because he finds everything we've ever said and done, whether it's on WFAN or it's on the Rico. But he writes this about Mark Vientos and Brett Beatty. And it's interesting for this discussion. He writes, "You're going to hate this, but it needs to happen. It's been exactly a year later, and we're back in the same scenario, just with a different candidate. Be proactive and find a suitor before you get trapped back into his suck vortex. If he keeps this up and recoups his value, sell the second you can." And it's a picture of Mark Vientos. And what Dan is saying is that last year, I kind of fell back in love with Brett Beatty. In fact, he forwarded me the email from May 11th, 2025. "Trade him." This is Brett Beatty. "The value will never be higher. And you know he's turning back into a pumpkin. Pull the trigger, David Stearns." And it's funny because I get what Dan is saying, and he's probably right. And I think most of us with the same brain would say, hey, if you can get something of value for Brett Beatty and Mark Vientos, you'd pull the trigger. I think we're all kind of agreeing that we're not going to re-fall in love with them. But here's where Dan is wrong. Here in the middle of May, with the way this team is constituted, they have to play them every day and hope they're good. They don't have a lot of other options. You know, the moment AJ Ewing comes up and Ryan Clifford comes up and Jacob Reimer's ready to come up and they've got like internal options that are ready, then sure. But in this moment, let's say a team called up and said, "Boy, we really need Mark Vientos. We're actually going to give you a decent young prospect for him." You can do it and say, "Well, his value's recouped, let's trade him." But what about this current team? Like, he needs to play every day right now. He's essentially the first baseman. So I get it. Don't fall back in love with Brett Beatty and Mark Vientos. But in 2026, in the middle of May, both of them are very important to this team. And they both are basically every single day players, with Brett Beatty now playing third base with Pichette at shortstop and Mark Vientos at first base. And what's changing that? Jorge Polanco is going to change that? Lindor's not coming back anytime soon. Mauricio's not coming back anytime soon. So you almost have to live with Brett Beatty and Mark Vientos as much as you want to cash out on their value.
Do you, because I hear that and I respect it, but at what point in time is it okay to think about trading them when their value is high?
July. I think that there'll be a reassessment a couple of weeks before the trade deadline. I mean, if the Mets are competing for a playoff spot. I think we'd all probably want to compete for a playoff spot. If they're not competing for a playoff spot, and there are worlds in which their value is recouped because they're playing well and maybe other guys aren't, and the Mets haven't made up the ground that they need to make up. So I think in July, sure, absolutely. I think I'd be open to a million things come July. But I think right now there's still enough season left where you're going to play it out with these guys and you're going to hope they'll perform.
Well, listen, it's May 5th when we're recording this podcast, so we're still very far away from July, technically, especially the deadline. Like, what would the record have to be? We're still close.
It's not the record. It's not the record. It's how many games out of a playoff spot you are. You know, years are different. You know, right now you look around the National League and, you know, the National League Central's played really well. St. Louis and Chicago and Cincinnati and the Brewers are always feisty and the Padres and the Dodgers. So it's more where are you standings wise that makes that decision. But we're 2 months away from it because you said it. It's May 5th, May 6th. I don't think these discussions are serious until the first week of July. So we're talking about 2 months of baseball where they have a lot of ground to make up. There's no doubt. And I'm not confident they're going to, but I think trading guys right now, it's not realistic. It's not happening. James writes, who does AJ Minter eventually replace? Love the pod. Appreciate you doing so many episodes. We appreciate it. Throughout this definitely not punctuatuitous start to the season. That's the word Gary Cohen used that has garnered a lot of attention. My question to you is about who AJ Minter replaces once he's ready to join the big club. I know there have been reports of a dip in velocity, but I can't help but think he'd be much better than a specific left-handed bullpen arm right now. The only issue is that bullpen arm is making $25 million, and I doubt he would agree to go to AAA. Yes, I'm obviously talking about Sean Manaea. Love the person, but that player has really lost all of his value since deciding against surgery for the loose bodies in his elbow. Kind of crazy seeing the likes of Edwin Diaz and Tarik Skubal with the same issue taking care of it immediately, while Manaea decided against doing so entirely. Just another thing on the long list of Mets mishaps that really chaps my ass. So who do you think in a vacuum Minter for Manaea would be right now? Do you think Stearns has the stones to make a move like that? And if not Manaea, who? Well, if not Manaea, the who's are either Austin Warren, who has options, so could simply go back down to the minor leagues as he already has, and they could DFA Craig Kimbrell. So Craig Kimbrell's been up and down. I think he's mostly been decent, so I'm not necessarily ready to DFA him. But I think those are the options if we're not including Sean Manaea. The Sean Manaea thing is complicated because you brought up the loose bodies. Everybody's different. And I don't mean everybody. I mean, everybody's body is different. So was Sean Manaea recommended have the surgery? Was this a Carlos Beltran situation where he refused? Or was this the doctor saying, yeah, you can pitch through it? Or I don't know. His body is just different now, different than Tarik Skubal and Edwin Diaz. Everything is not the same, even if the injury sounds the same. So I think the easy thing to do is to send Austin Warren down as good as he is, just because you're not losing anybody. I think the other option is to kind of IL Sean Manaea, and maybe he needs rest because of these loose bodies. He probably doesn't. He probably doesn't want any rest. But I think those are the three options you're looking at, or someone gets hurt that we don't expect. You know, all of a sudden we hear that there's an issue to name the guy, you know, somebody. I think the other option is to send down Christian Scott if they want to eventually stretch out Tobias Myers and put him in the rotation, though. I think Christian Scott's last start was impressive, and we'll see what he does in his next start. Maybe that'll kind of play into what they do with AJ Minter. But the dip in velocity is a little bit concerning. It's a little bit concerning. Can he still get guys out throwing 92, 93? Sure. Is he still an upgrade over what they currently have? Yeah, I think so. Peter writes, Pete in New Jersey, are we the problem? Are we impatient children who want what they want when they want it now? I'm not saying we should resemble the filthies, but I'll bet us booing doesn't help the team play better. This road trip, 4 games in, has been positive, looking in the right direction. The home crowd does not care about us at all. were neither a threat nor a prize, just bizarro Yankees hitting the town. So they just play and they show not a huge improvement, but some improvement, and that could lead to getting on a roll. What do you think? I think that there's obviously pressure when you're playing at home, and I'm sure that you hear the boos a little bit, but I think it's an excuse. You're a major leaguer. You're making a lot of money. And the one thing I'll say about Met fans and the way our crowds have reacted, no one is looking to boo. No one has booed anybody before they've done anything. The boos have been after the fact. The boos have been responding to the way guys have played or strikeouts or bad moments or LD offenses. So it's not like we're out there just looking to boo people. A Waltep writes, he didn't sign a name, so I'm just saying his screen name. Now that they haven't had, not that they haven't had their bad moments, but the team has generally pitched pretty well this year. Top 10 in batting average against, whip, and have struck out the most batters in the league. With some of the dead weight already being caught, there's at least a path back from the abyss through the pitching staff, giving them a chance to win a vast majority of the time. Chip away, get healthy, and who knows? Yeah, that's kind of my philosophy right now, which is win these series. I'd love to sweep the Rockies. I'd love to, you know, go on a 9-game winning streak. I don't necessarily think they're good enough to do that. So I think at 9 games under 500, you go win the next 2 series, you're 7 games under 500. You win the Tigers series, you're 6 games under 500. You know, and you try to slowly get back to respectability. That's, I think, the goal. And then, you know, the hope is at some point Francisco Lindor is healthy. At some point, Jorge Polanco is healthy and, dare I say, contributing, and the team starts to play better. I think the problem with that is that there's a lot of hope involved. It's not as if there's a cavalry coming. You know, I know A.J. Ewing is tearing it up. He did take an 0-for on Tuesday, and I think at some point they will clearly call him up. But you can't look at him as a savior. You can't look at him as someone that's going to come up and completely spark the team. I think we hope that's the case, and I would do it right now. I see no reason to. In fact, I'm going to try to find the email. We've got so many, I say, but there was an email comparing the amount of time that Carson Bench spent in the minor leagues versus the amount of time A.J. Ewing has spent in the minor leagues at AA and AAA, and the time spent down there is very close. There we go. I think I found it. Dallas DeVries sent the email. I had to go through a lot of people congratulating me about Juan Soto leading off as if I accomplished something. Like it was me. There was one email, Hoff, that I thought was very funny. It said, who was more disrespected? Evan Roberts by Carlos Mendoza for not getting credit for the Juan Soto leadoff, or Pete Hoffman by Evan Roberts for not being included in the Rico Brugna, I'm sorry, in the My Mets Bible acknowledgments when I wrote the book? I thought that was a very good question. So who do you think's been more disrespected, you or me?
I think that I never really reminded you or begged to be in the book, and the book was in process a long time before, I think, the Rico, maybe not, I don't know, but regardless, you were the front and center of Juan Soto batting leadoff. So, I mean, you posed the question to Carlos Mendoza. So this is not like, I pulled this out of my tush today. You, Evan Roberts is Juan Soto leadoff. That equaled, that's the same thing. So you definitely got disrespected more than I did.
What I need to have happen, though, because Mendy's tried a lot of different lineups, I need this to stick. Like this, if this is just a couple of days and then it goes away, we're going to forget about it. It's like, he tried it, whatever. I need this to be the lineup that he sticks with as the Mets come out of the abyss, play better baseball, and we just start to think of Juan Soto as the leadoff hitter for the New York Mets. That's the goal right now, because so far it's only been one game. There's a part of me that thinks on Wednesday, 9:20 first pitch, I'm going to start putting my scorecard together at 8:30, and I'm going to see freaking Bo Bichette leading off, and I'll be annoyed.
Yeah, well, winning helps. So if that's the first thing, is that they did win the first game. But also, I mean, I don't trust anything right now because this lineup is so anemic. You know, I know Carson Bench started to hit a little bit. Mark Vientos has hit a little bit. But all it takes is one game of them going like 0-for-3 each, and it goes right back to Juan Soto going to 3 or 4.
No, I know. I'm already thinking about one other big lineup change I kind of want to make, and this is going to sound nuts because Carson Bench is slowly getting hot, but yeah. I'd bat him third. I would. I would go Soto, Bichette, Bench, 1-2-3. And I want you to hear me out on this. He continues to hit MJ Melendez third. You cannot hit MJ Melendez third when you're pinch hitting for him with Austin Slater in the sixth and seventh innings.
Yeah, well, you also shouldn't have Austin Slater on the roster, but that's besides the point. Listen, are you gonna kill me on this? I used to say bat Brandon Nimmo ninth for a reason. I'd keep Carson Bench there. There's no reason to move him up.
I think in a normal world, I would agree with you. Like, I think I was suggesting that in spring training, but I think with their current state of the lineup, it's I think you've got to do crazy things. I mean, Francisco Alvarez was hitting third like 5 days ago. Now he's hitting eighth. I mean, that's all you need to know.
Yeah.
Here's the email I wanted to mention about AJ Ewing and Carson Bench. Dallas writes, Carson Bench, 56 games in AA, 978 OPS. In AAA, 583 OPS, 11 home runs, 7 stolen bases. AJ Ewing, 53 games in AA with an 891 OPS plus AAA, 1,196 OPS, 2 home runs, 28 stolen bases. They have played roughly the same amount of games in the upper minors. Ewing will pass Bench this week. Ewing is outperforming Bench at roughly a year younger. The Mets are playing a cast of DFA guys. They should be giving Ewing a shot right now. What better time than Colorado and Arizona? Yeah, I just, you know, here's what I want to know. And David Stearns is kind of hid from the media now for a little over a week. He usually meets the media somewhat frequently. He let out the quote in the Anthony DeComo article that Carlos Mendoza was safe, but we haven't heard from him in a couple of weeks. What I want to know from David Stearns and even, you know, anyone else, why was Carson Bench ready and AJ Ewing not? That's it. Like, was it just the spring training? Like, hey, we gave him a shot in spring training. You look good. Because in terms of experience at AA and experience at AAA, Dallas lays it out pretty good. Like, it's very similar. So why not? And you could argue right now, it's the fact that they could use AJ Ewing at the major league level a lot more than they could have used Carson Bench making the team out of spring training. I know the Mike Tauchman injury probably made it more obvious, but they could use AJ Ewing up here. And it's a great point. I mean, this roster now features Andy Ibañez and Austin Slater and Vidal Brujan. Brujan has to be here because they need a backup shortstop, so that's a little bit different. But how much time does he need? Like, what do you need to see AJ Ewing do at AAA? How many at-bats does it need to be? Because if you're judging it based on need at the major league level, then he should already be here. If that's what you're judging it on, if you're judging it on something he needs to do, then just let us know what he needs to do. I know it's a small amount of time at AAA. I get it. But to Dallas's point, it's not like Carson Bench played a lot at AAA. So,
Let me ask you a question, though, because it's not just that, too. It's also what are the people that are in the majors right now doing, right? Like Austin Slater, I know it's been a very small sample size, but Austin Slater, we know what his ceiling is. It's not very high, right? Like, so we know that the people are struggling right now. Why are we not moving ahead with AJ Ewing? You telling me he can't be better than Ibañez or Slater or whomever's playing right now? You telling me he's not going to be better? And listen, Carson Bench's defense has really started to make a difference.
No doubt.
So I'm not going to sit there and talk about that at all. And he's hit the ball a little bit better recently, but Carson Bench has struggled mightily this first month of the season. He's still batting under the Mendoza. So, like, if AJ Ewing could do anything productive, I don't see why he can't be up here right now.
Yeah. I kind of agree, and I'm curious when that moment will happen. So we're in the midst of three games against the Colorado Rockies. I think with the horrible weather on Wednesday and then the beautiful weather, but a day game on Thursday, I hate to tell you, I take a split. But a split means winning a series. And winning a series means it would be just the first time this season they've won back-to-back series. They've got five games left on this trip. The two with Colorado, the three with Arizona. It's about chopping wood, as the cliche says. Just slowly gain ground. You go 3-2, you feel pretty good. You go 3-2, you're feeling like, okay, progress is being made before they come home and take on Detroit and the New York Yankees. We will have a Rico Bronya when this series concludes. That'll be late on Thursday night because I do not think I'll be able to watch that game live, that 3 o'clock game Thursday. There's a lot going on. So, and by a lot going on, I mean like a Little League game of some sort. So there'll be a Rico Bronya at some point on Thursday night. That's why if you subscribe to the WFAN channel on YouTube, you'll get an update as soon as we go live. Or just download the Rico Bronya and subscribe wherever you download your podcast, and it'll pop up in your inbox whenever it's ready. We appreciate you hanging out with us on a unscheduled off day, snow day edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.